Mostly deer rifles and shotguns, some long-barreled pistols, and that was pretty creepy. She lived in a log house past the edge of town off the asphalt. It was always kind of dangerous over there because the old man had a reputation for being mean. Nice enough when he'd been working, but when not, you'd have to look out. He'd be drinking and get wrecked, and then things would turn evil. He'd come into the room and mutter something through locked teeth. Once he ran me and a friend of mine off with a shotgun. One of the reasons I liked going there, besides puppy love, was that they had Jimmy Rogers records, old 78s in the house. I used to sit there mesmerized, listening to the blue yodeler singing, "I'm a Tennessee hustler, I don't have to work." I didn't want to have to work either. I was looking at all the guns up at Ray's place and thought about my old-time girlfriend. Wondered what she was doing. The last time I'd seen her, she was heading west. Everybody said she looked like Brigitte Bardot, and she did. There was other stuff in the room, other delights. A Remington typewriter, the neck piece of a saxophone with a swan-like curve, odd photos, one of Florence Nightingale with a pet owl on her shoulder, novelty postcards, a picture postcard from California with a palm tree. I'd never been to California. It seemed like it was the place of some special glamorous race. I knew that movies came from there and that there was a folk club in Los Angeles called the Ash Grove. I used to dream about playing there. It seemed so far away. I never thought I'd ever get out there. When I finally did arrive in California, my songs and my reputation had preceded me. I'd be playing at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium and meeting all the performers who had recorded my songs. Of all of the versions of my recorded songs, the Johnny Rivers version of Positively 4th Street was my favorite. It was obvious that we were from the same side of town, had been read the same citations, came from the same musical family, and were cut from the same cloth. I liked his version better than mine. Most of the cover versions of my songs seemed to take them out into left field somewhere, but Rivers' version had the mandate down, the attitude and melodic sense to complete and surpass even the feeling that I'd put into it. It would be a few more years before I'd reach Sunland. I stared around the room, looked over towards the back window, and saw that twilight was coming. Ice was stacked up, thick, all along the fire escape rail. I stared down into the alleyway and then up to the rooftops from tower to tower. Snow was beginning to fall again, covered the cement-covered earth. If I was building any new kind of life to live, it really didn't seem that way. It's not as if I had turned in any old one to live it. If anything, I wanted to understand things and then be free of them. I needed to learn how to telescope things, ideas. Things were too big to see all at once, like all the books in the library, everything laying around on the tables. You might be able to put it all into one paragraph or into one verse of a song if you could get it right. Sometimes you know things have to change, are going to change, but you can only feel it. Like in that song of Sam Cooke's, "Change is gonna come." But you don't know it in a purposeful way. Little things foreshadow what's coming, but you may not recognize them. But then something immediate happens and you're in another world. You jump into the unknown. You have an instinctive understanding of it. You're set free. You don't need to ask questions and you already know the score. It seems like when that happens, it happens fast, like magic. But it's really not like that. It isn't like some dull boom goes off and the moment has arrived. Your eyes don't spring open and suddenly you're very quick and sure about something. It's more deliberate. It's more like you've been working in the light of day and then you see one day that it's getting dark early, that it doesn't matter where you are. It won't do you any good. It's a reflective thing. Somebody holds the mirror up, unlocks the door, something jerks it open and you're shoved in and your head has to go into a different place. Sometimes it takes a certain somebody to make you realize it. Mike Seeger had that effect on me. I'd seen him recently up at Camilla Adams' place. Camilla was an exotic, dark-haired lady, a full-bodied woman who looked like Ava Gardner. She'd usually be with the type of guys that looked like private detectives. She was close friends with Cisco Houston. Cisco had a terminal disease, and he would be doing some of his last few performances at Folk City, and I was there to hear him. I heard him a lot on the Woody Guthrie records, and also on his own records. All the cowboy songs, lumberjack and railroad songs, and bad man ballads. He was a perfect counterpart to Woody and had a soothing baritone voice, had traveled extensively and worked all the towns with Woody, made records with him, went to sea with him on a merchant marine ship during World War II. Sisko, handsome and dashing with a pencil-thin mustache, looked like a riverboat gambler, like Errol Flynn. Sisko was sitting with Camilla during a break in his set, and she introduced me to him, told Sisko I was a young folk singer and sang a lot of Woody's songs. Sisko was gracious and had a dignified air about him, talked like he sang. I'd watched him perform, and even though he was a hair's breadth away from death, you suspected nothing. Camilla was having a get-together for him later in the week, a bon voyage party, and she invited me to come by. She lived in a large apartment on Fifth Avenue near Washington Square Park on the top floor of a Romanesque mansion. I showed up at Camilla's with my sort of part-time girlfriend, Dolores Dixon, the girl singer from the New World Singers, a group I was pretty close with. Dolores was from Alabama, an ex-reporter and an ex-dancer. As we came through the door, I could see the rooms were already swarming with people, the bohemian crowd, a lot of old-timers. I was wearing a thick flannel shirt under a sheepskin jacket, peaked cap, khaki pants, and motorcycle boots. Dolores was wearing a long beaver fur coat over a nightgown that looked like a dress. I saw a lot of people here that I'd meet again not too far off, a lot of the folk community hierarchy, who were all pretty indifferent towards me at the time and showed very little enthusiasm. They could tell I wasn't from the North Carolina mountains, nor was I a very commercial cosmopolitan singer either. I just didn't fit in. They didn't know what to make of me. Pete Seeger did, though, and he said hello. Sisko brought all kinds of people together. There were union guys there, ex-union guys, labor organizers. Looked like tugboat captains or baggy-pantsed outfielders or roustabouts. Some people were there from the art world. Irwin Silber, the editor of the folk magazine Sing Out, was there too. In a few years' time, he would castigate me publicly in his magazine for turning my back on the folk community. It was an angry letter. I liked Irwin, but I couldn't relate to it. What I did was to take simple folk changes and put new imagery and attitude to them, use catchphrases and metaphor combined with a new set of ordinances that evolved into something different that had not been heard before. Silber scolded me as if he alone and few others had the keys to the real world. I knew what I was doing, though, and I wasn't going to take a step back or retreat for anybody. There were Broadway and off-Broadway actors at Camilla's place, too. Diana Sands, an electrifying actress who I might have been secretly in love with, and some others. A lot of musicians and singers. Millard Thomas, who played guitar for Harry Belafonte, was also there. Harry was the best balladeer in the land, and everybody knew it. He was a fantastic artist, sang about lovers and slaves, chain gang workers, saints and sinners and children. There never was a performer who crossed so many lines as Harry. The folk purists had a problem with him, but Harry, who could have kicked the shit out of all of them, couldn't be bothered. Said that all folk singers were interpreters. Said it in a public way, as if someone had summoned him to set the record straight. He even said he hated pop songs, thought they were junk. I could identify with Harry in all kinds of ways. Sometime in the past, he had been barred from the door of the world-famous nightclub, the Copacabana, because of his color, and then later he'd be headlining the joint. You've got to wonder how that would make somebody feel emotionally. Astoundingly, and as unbelievable as it might have seemed, I'd be making my professional recording debut with Harry, playing harmonica on one of his albums called Midnight Special. Strangely enough, this was the only one memorable recording date that would stand out in my mind for years to come. Even my own sessions would become lost in abstractions. With Belafonte, I felt like I'd become anointed in some kind of way. He did the same thing for me that Gorgeous George did. Harry was that rare type of character that radiates greatness, and you hope that some of it rubs off on you. The man commands respect. You know he never took the easy path, though he could have. It was getting late, and me and Dolores were about to leave when I suddenly spotted Mike Seeger in the room. When I saw him, my brain became wide awake, and I was instantly in a good mood. I'd seen Mike play previously with the New Lost City Ramblers. He was extraordinary, gave me an eerie feeling. As for being a folk musician, he was the supreme archetype. He could push a stake through Dracula's black heart. He was the romantic, egalitarian, and revolutionary type all at once. Had chivalry in his blood. Like some figure from a restored monarchy, he'd come to purify the church. You couldn't imagine him making a big deal out of anything. I also heard him play on his own in Alan Lomax's loft on 3rd Street. Lomax, the great folk archivist, used to have parties twice a month where he'd bring in folk singers to play. Mike played The 5 Mile Chase, Mighty Mississippi, Claude Allen Blues, and some other songs. He played all the instruments, whatever the song called for, the banjo, the fiddle, the mandolin, auto harp, and the guitar, even harmonica in the rack. Mike was skin-stinging. He was tense, poker-faced, and radiated telepathy, wore a snowy white shirt and silver sleeve bands. He played on all the various planes, the full index of old-time styles, played in the genres and had the idioms mastered. Delta blues, ragtime, minstrel songs, buck and wing, dance reels, play party, hymns and gospel. Being there and seeing him up close, something hit me. Before he was even born, this music had to be in his blood. Nobody could just learn this stuff, and it dawned on me that I might have to change my inner thought patterns, that I would have to start believing in possibilities that I wouldn't have allowed before, that I had been closing my creativity down to a very narrow, controllable scale, that things had become too familiar and I might have to disorientate myself. I knew I was doing things right, was on the right road, was getting all the knowledge immediately and firsthand, memorizing words and melodies and changes. But now I saw that it could take me the rest of my life to make practical use of that knowledge, and Mike didn't have to do that. He was just right there. He was too good, and you can't be too good, not in this world anyway. In order to be as good as that, you just about have to be him and nobody else. Folk songs are evasive. The truth about life, and life is more or less a lie. But then again, that's exactly the way we want it to be. We wouldn't be comfortable with it any other way. A folk song has over 1,000 faces, and you must meet them all if you want to play this stuff. A folk song might vary in meaning, and it might not appear the same from one moment to the next. Depends on who's playing and who's listening. The thought occurred to me that maybe I'd have to write my own folk songs, ones that Mike didn't know. That was a startling thought. Up till then, I'd gone some places and thought I knew my way around, and then it struck me I'd never been there before. You open a door to a dark room and you think you know what's there, where everything is arranged, but you really don't know until you step inside. I can't say I'd seen any performances that were like spiritual experiences until I went to Lomax's loft. I pondered it. I wasn't ready to act on it, but knew somehow, though, that if I wanted to stay playing music, that I would have to claim a larger part of myself. I would have to overlook a lot of things that might even need attention. But that was all right. There were things that I probably felt totally powerless over anyway. I had the map, could even draw it freehand if I had to. Now I knew I'd have to throw it away. Not today, not tonight, sometime soon, though. It was time for me and Dolores to leave, so I said goodbye to Cisco, talked with him for a moment, told him that I'd been visiting Woody Guthrie in the hospital. Cisco smiled, said that Woody never tried to camouflage anything, did he, and told me to say hello to him next time I went. I nodded, said goodbye, walked out into the hallway and down the stairs, went out through the lobby. Outside, Dolores and I stopped and looked up at the Romanesque pillars surmounted by carved mythological beasts. It was freezing cold. I put my hands in my pockets, and we headed off toward 6th Avenue. There was a lot of action and people on the street, and I watched them go by. T.S. Eliot wrote a poem once where there were people walking to and fro, and everybody taking the opposite direction was appearing to be running away. That was what it looked like that night, and often would for some time to come. In Beyond Good and Evil, Nietzsche talks about feeling old at the beginning of his life. I felt like that, too. Somebody told me a few weeks later that Cisco had died. America was changing. I had a feeling of destiny and I was riding the changes. New York was as good a place to be as any. My consciousness was beginning to change too, change and stretch. One thing for sure, if I wanted to compose folk songs, I would need some kind of new template, some philosophical identity that wouldn't burn out. It would have to come on its own from the outside. Without knowing it in so many words, it was beginning to happen. Sometimes Paul Clayton and Ray would talk through the night. They called New York City the capital of the world. They would sit at two tables. Either they'd lean back against the wall or forward on the table, drink coffee and glasses of brandy. Clayton, a good friend of Van Ronk's, was from New Bedford, Mass., the whaling town. He sang a lot of sea shanties, had a Puritan ancestry, but some of his old relatives had been from early Virginia families. Ray, who was from Virginia, had ancestors who had fought on both sides of the Civil War. I leaned back against the wall and shut my eyes, their voices drifting into my head like voices talking from another world. They talked about dogs and fishing and forest fires, love and monarchies and the Civil War. Ray had said that New York City was the city that won the Civil War, came out on top, that the wrong side had lost, that slavery was evil, and that the thing would have died out anyway, Lincoln or no Lincoln. I heard him say it and thought it was a mysterious and bad thing to say, but if he said it, he said it, and that's all there is to it. When I woke up later in the day, the place was empty. After a while, I walked downstairs and left to go meet a singing pal of mine, Mark Spolstra. We planned to meet up at a creepy but convenient little coffee house on Bleecker Street near Thompson, run by a character called the Dutchman. The Dutchman resembled Rasputin, the Siberian mad monk. When I got to the place, Spolstra was already there, and so was the Dutchman. The Dutchman was lying dead in the doorway of his storefront. There were splotches of blood on the ice and red lines in the snow like spider webs. The old man who owned the building had been waiting for him and had stuck a knife in him. The Dutchman was still wearing his fur hat, long brown overcoat, and riding boots, and his head was propped up on the stoop under the pearl-gray sky. The problem had something to do with the Dutchman refusing to pay his rent and being belligerent about it. A lot of times he'd force the old man out physically. The little old man had taken enough and snapped. He must have thrown himself through the air like Houdini. It must have taken much skill and faculty to stick a knife through the heavy brown overcoat. Seeing the Dutchman lying there, his long brown stringy hair and frosted beard, he looked like a mercenary who could have fallen at Gettysburg. The old man was sitting inside with the door open, facing the sidewalk surrounded by a couple of cops. His face was misshapen, looked queer-formed, almost mutilated, like putty in color. His eyes were dead, and he had no idea where he was. The power of the scene somehow jarred my mind, though. It reminded me of some still images I'd seen of the Civil War. How much did I know about that cataclysmic event? Probably close to nothing. So I asked Van Ronk what he knew about states' rights. He almost looked bemused. The Civil War was fought to free slaves, he said. There's no mystery to it. But then again, Van Ronk would never let you forget that he had his own way of seeing things. Look, my man, even if those elite southern barons would have freed their captives, it wouldn't have done them any good. We still would have gone down there and annihilated them, invaded them for their land. It's called imperialism. Van Ronk took the Marxist point of view. It was one big battle between two rival economic systems is what it was. One thing about Van Ronk, what he said was never dull or muddy. Once I was talking to the folks back home and my father got on the line, asked me where I was. I told him that I was in New York City, capital of the world. He said, that's a good joke. But it wasn't a joke. New York City was the magnet, the force that draws objects to it. But take away the magnet and everything will fall apart. There were about five or six rooms in Ray and Chloe's apartment. In one of them there was this magnificent roll-top desk. I sat down at it, firm-footed, and pulled out a sheet of paper and dashed off a letter to my cousin Renee. Renee and I were pretty close growing up. We rode the same bicycle, one of those Schwinn's with coaster brakes. Sometimes she'd come along with me when I played at different places, even embroidered a shirt for me to play in that was pretty flashy, and she sewed stripes of ribbon down the sides of a pair of pants. One time she asked me why I was using a different name when I played, especially in the neighboring towns. Like, didn't I want people to know who I was? Who's Elston Gunn? She asked. That's not you, is it? I said, you'll see. The Elston Gunn name thing was only temporary. What I was going to do as soon as I left home was just call myself Robert Allen. As far as I was concerned, that was who I was. That's what my parents named me. It sounded like the name of a Scottish king, and I liked it. Sometime later, I'd seen some poems by Dylan Thomas. Dylan and Allen sounded similar. Robert Dylan, Robert Allen. I couldn't decide. The letter D came on stronger, but Robert Dylan didn't look or sound as good as Robert Allen. People always called me either Robert or Bobby, but Bobby Dylan sounded too skittish to me, and besides, there was already a Bobby Darin, a Bobby V, a Bobby Rydell, a Bobby Neely, and a lot of other Bobbies. Bob Dylan looked and sounded better than Bob Allen. The first time I was asked my name in the Twin Cities, I instinctively and automatically, without thinking, simply said, Bob Dylan. Now, I had to get used to people calling me Bob. I'd never been called that before, and it took me some time to respond to people who called me that. As far as Bobby Zimmerman goes, I'm going to give this to you right straight, and you can check it out. One of the early presidents of the San Bernardino Angels was Bobby Zimmerman, and he was killed in 1964 on the Bass Lake Run. The muffler fell off his bike, he made a U-turn to retrieve it in front of the pack, and was instantly killed. That person is gone. That was the end of him. I finished the letter to Rini and signed it Bobby. That's how she knew me, and always would. Speaking of Bobbies, my old friend and fellow performer Bobby V had a new song out on the charts called Take Good Care of My Baby. Bobby V was from Fargo, North Dakota, raised not too far from me. In the summer of 59, he had a regional hit record out called Susie Baby on a local label. His band was called The Shadows, and I had hitchhiked out there and talked my way into joining his group as a piano player on some of his local gigs, one in the basement of a church. I played a few shows with him, but he really didn't need a piano player, and besides, it was hard finding a piano that was in tune in the halls that he played. His current song, Take Good Care of My Baby, was slick as ever. I wanted to see him again, so I took the D train out to the Brooklyn Paramount Theater on Flatbush Avenue, where he was appearing. Bobby came out to see me, was down to earth as ever, was wearing shiny silk suit and narrow tie, seemed genuinely glad to see me, didn't even act surprised. We talked for a little while. He asked me about New York, what it was like to be here. Lot of walking. Gotta keep your feet in good shape, I said. I told him I was playing the folk clubs, but it was impossible to give him any indication of what it was all about. He'd become a crowd pleaser in the pop world. As for myself, I had nothing against pop songs, but the definition of pop was changing. They just didn't seem to be as good as they used to be. I loved songs like Without a Song, Old Man River, Stardust, and hundreds of others. My favorite of all the new ones was Moon River. I could sing that in my sleep. My huckleberry friend, too, was up there, waiting around the bend maybe on 14th Street. At Ray's, where there weren't many folk records, I used to play the phenomenal Ebb Tide by Frank Sinatra a lot, and it had never failed to fill me with awe. The lyrics were so mystifying and stupendous. When Frank sang that song, I could hear everything in his voice. Death, God, and the universe, everything. I had other things to do, though, and I couldn't be listening to that stuff much. Standing there with Bobby, I didn't want to act selfishly on his time, so we said goodbye and I walked down the side of the theater out one of the side doors. There were throngs of young girls waiting for him in the cold outside the building. I cut back out through them into the press of cabs and private cars plowing slowly through the icy streets and headed back to the subway station. I wouldn't see Bobby V again for another 30 years, and though things would be a lot different, I'd always thought of him as a brother. Every time I'd see his name somewhere, it was like he was in the room. Greenwich Village was full of folk clubs, bars, coffee houses, and those of us who played them all played the old-timey folk songs, rural blues, and dance tunes. There were a few who wrote their own songs, like Tom Paxton and Len Chandler, and because they used old melodies with new words, they were pretty much accepted. Both Len and Tom wrote topical songs, songs where you'd pick articles out of the newspapers, fractured, demented stuff, some nun getting married, a high school teacher taking a flying leap off the Brooklyn Bridge, tourists who robbed a gas station, Broadway beauty being beaten and left in the snow, things like that. I wrote a couple and slipped them into my repertoire, but really didn't think they were here nor there. I had been singing a lot of topical songs anyway. Songs about real events were always topical. You could usually find some kind of point of view in it, though, and take it for what it was worth. And the writer doesn't have to be accurate. Could tell you anything and you're going to believe it. Billy Gashad, the man who presumably wrote the Jesse James ballad, Makes you believe that Jesse robbed from the rich and gave to the poor and was shot down by a dirty little coward. By all accounts, though, James was a bloodthirsty killer who was anything but the Robin Hood sung about in the song. But Billy Gashaud has the last word, and he spins it around. Topical songs weren't protest songs. The term protest singer didn't exist any more than the term singer-songwriter. You were a performer or you weren't, that was about it. A folk singer or not one. Songs of dissent was a term people used, but even that was rare. I tried to explain later that I didn't think I was a protest singer, that there'd been a screw-up. I didn't think I was protesting anything any more than I thought that Woody Guthrie songs were protesting anything. I didn't think of Woody as a protest singer. If he is one, so is Sleepy John Estes and Jelly Roll Morton. What I was hearing pretty regularly, though, were rebellion songs, and those really moved me. The Clancy brothers, Tom, Patty, and Liam, and their buddy Tommy Makem sang them all the time. I got to be friends with Liam and began going after hours to the White Horse Tavern on Hudson Street, which was mainly an Irish bar frequented mostly by guys from the old country. All through the night they would sing drinking songs, country ballads, and rousing rebel songs that would lift the roof. The rebellion songs were a really serious thing. The language was flashy and provocative. A lot of action in the words, all sung with great gusto. The singer always had a merry light in his eye. Had to have it. I loved these songs and could still hear them in my head long after into the next day. They weren't protest songs, though. They were rebel ballads. Even in a simple, melodic, wooing ballad, there'd be rebellion waiting round the corner. You couldn't escape it. There were songs like that in my repertoire, too, where something lovely was suddenly upturned. But instead of rebellion showing up, it would be death itself, the Grim Reaper. Rebellion spoke to me louder. The rebel was alive and well, romantic and honorable. The Grim Reaper wasn't like that. I was beginning to think I might want to change over. The Irish landscape wasn't too much like the American landscape, though, so I'd have to find some cuneiform tablets, some archaic grail to lighten the way. I had grasped the idea of what kind of songs I wanted to write. I just didn't know how to do it yet. I did everything fast. Thought fast, ate fast, talked fast, and walked fast. I even sang my songs fast. I needed to slow my mind down if I was going to be a composer with anything to say. I couldn't exactly put in words what I was looking for, but I began searching in principle for it, over at the New York Public Library, a building that radiates triumph and glory when you walk inside. In one of the upstairs reading rooms, I started reading articles in newspapers on microfilm from 1855 to about 1865 to see what daily life was like. I wasn't so much interested in the issues as intrigued by the language and rhetoric of the times. It wasn't like it was another world, but the same one, only with more urgency, and the issue of slavery wasn't the only concern. There were new items about reform movements, anti-gambling leagues, rising crime, child labor, temperance, slave wage factories, loyalty oaths, and religious revivals. You get the feeling that the newspapers themselves could explode, and lightning will burn and everybody will perish. Everybody uses the same God, quotes the same Bible and law and literature. Plantation slavecrats of Virginia are accused of breeding and selling their own children. In the northern cities, there's a lot of discontent and the debt is piling high and seems out of control. Every state of mind opposed by another. Christian piety and weird mind philosophies turned on their heads. You wonder how people so united by geography and religious ideals could become such bitter enemies. After a while, you become aware of nothing but a culture of feeling, black days, of schism, evil for evil. The common destiny of the human being getting thrown off course. It's all one long funeral song. The suffering is endless and the punishment is going to be forever. It's all so unrealistic, grandiose, and sanctimonious at the same time. There was a difference in the concept of time, too. In the South, people lived their lives with sunup, high noon, sunset, spring, summer. In the North, people lived by the clock, the factory stroke, whistles and bells. Northerners had to beyond time. In some ways, the Civil War would be a battle between two kinds of time. Abolition of slavery didn't even seem to be an issue when the first shots were fired at Fort Sumter. It all makes you feel creepy. Back there, America was put on the cross, died, and was resurrected. There was nothing synthetic about it. The god-awful truth of that would be the all-encompassing template behind everything that I would write. I crammed my head full of as much of this stuff as I could stand and locked it away in my mind out of sight, left it alone. Figured I could send a truck back for it later. Down in the village, nothing seemed wrong. Life was not complex. Everybody was looking for openings. Some would get them and then they'd be gone and others never did. Mine was coming, but not just yet. Len Chandler, a classically trained musician from Ohio, was on the bill with me at the Gaslight and we got to be friends. One of his most colorful songs had been about a negligent school bus driver in Colorado who accidentally drove a bus full of kids down a cliff. It had an original melody, and because I liked the melody so much, I wrote my own set of lyrics to it. Len didn't seem to mind. We'd drink coffee and look through the daily newspapers left behind at the counter to see if there was song material in any of it. After seeing the newspapers at the New York Public Library, these papers seemed almost threadbare and dull. France was in the news and had exploded an atom bomb in the Sahara Desert. France had just been booted out of North Vietnam by Ho Chi Minh after 100 years of colonial rule. The French had been plundering the country for years. The press reported Hanoi was grubby and cheerless. Everybody rode a bicycle and did calisthenics in public 3 times a day. The newspapers made it sound as if it were a weird place. The Vietnamese might have to be straightened out. Might have to send some Americans over there. There'd be articles about things like new modern-day phobias, like fear of flowers, fear of the dark, the height, fear of crossing bridges, snakes, fear of getting old, fear of clouds. Just any old thing could be frightening. My big fear was that my guitar would go out of tune. Len and I thought this stuff was idiotic. Reality was not so simple, and everybody had their own take on it. Jean Genet's play The Balcony was being performed in the village, and it portrayed a world as a mammoth cat house where chaos rules the universe, where man is alone and abandoned in a meaningless cosmos. The play has a strong sense of focus, and from what I've seen about the Civil War period, it could have been written 100 years ago. The songs I'd write would be like that, too. They wouldn't conform to modern ideas. I hadn't begun yet writing streams of songs as I would. The dominant myth of the day seemed to be that anybody could do anything, even go to the moon. If you were an indecisive person, you could become a leader in Wir Lederhosen. If you were a housewife, you could become a glamour girl with rhinestone sunglasses. If you're old, you can be young. Anything was possible. It was almost like a war against the self. One guy who kept reappearing on the news was Carol Chessman. He was on death row in California after being tried and convicted of raping young women. He had a creative way of doing it. Strapped a flashing red light to the top of his automobile and then pulled the girls over to the side of the road, ordering them out, hauling them into the woods, robbing and raping them. An anti-death penalty group had asked Len to write a song about Chessman. How do you write a song about a pariah who rapes young women? What would be the angle? He asked me as if his imagination was actually on fire. I don't know, Len. I guess you'd have to build it slowly. Maybe start with the red lights. Len never did write the song, but I think someone else did. One thing about Chandler was that he was fearless, a daredevil. One freezing winter's night, I sat behind him on his Vespa motor scooter, riding full throttle across the Brooklyn Bridge, and my heart just about shot up in my mouth. The bike was speeding on a crisscross grid in the high winds, and I felt like I could have gone overboard at any time. Weaving in and out of the night's traffic, it scared the lights out of me. Sliding all over the iced-up steel, I was on the edge the whole way, but I could feel that Chandler was in control, his eyes unblinking and centered steadfast. No doubt about it, heaven was on his side. I've only felt like that about a few people. When I wasn't staying at Van Ronk's, I'd usually stay at Ray's place, get back sometime before dawn, mount the dark stairs, and carefully close the door behind me. I shoved off into the sofa bed like entering a vault. Ray was not a guy who had nothing on his mind. He seemed to have some golden grip on reality, didn't sweat the small stuff, quoted the Psalms, and slept with a pistol near his bed. At times, he could say things that had too much edge. Once he said that President Kennedy wouldn't last out his term because he was a Catholic. When he said it, it made me think about my grandmother, who said to me that the Pope is the king of the Jews. She lived back in Duluth on the top floor of a duplex on 5th Street. From a window in the back room, you could see Lake Superior, ominous and foreboding, iron bulk freighters and barges off in the distance, sound of foghorns to my right and left. My grandmother had only one leg and had been a seamstress. Sometimes on weekends, my parents would drive down from Iron Range to Duluth and drop me off at her place for a couple of days. She was a dark lady, smoked a pipe. The other side of my family was more light-skinned and fair. My grandmother's voice possessed a haunting accent, face always set in half-despairing expression. Life for her hadn't been easy. She'd come to America from Odessa, a seaport town in southern Russia. It was a town not unlike Duluth, the same kind of temperament, climate, and landscape, and right on the edge of a big body of water. Originally, she'd come out from Turkey, sailed from Trabzon, a port town across the Black Sea, the sea that the ancient Greeks called the Euxine, the one Lord Byron wrote about in Don Juan. Her family was from Kagsman, a town in Turkey near the Armenian border, and the family name had been Kyrgyz. My grandfather's parents had also come from that same area, where they had been mostly shoemakers and leather workers. My grandmother's ancestors had been from Constantinople. As a teenager, I used to sing the Richie Valens song, In a Turkish Town, with the lines in it about the mystery Turks and stars above. There were no Richie Valens records up at Ray's place, Turkish Town or otherwise. Mostly it was classical music and jazz bands. There were Bach fugues and Berlioz symphonies, symphonic poems by virtuoso pianists, string serenades and themes that sound like polka dances. Polka dances always got my blood pumping. That was the first type of loud, live music I ever heard. On Saturday nights, the taverns were filled with polka bands. I'd listen to a lot of jazz and bebop records, too. If I needed to wake up real quick, I'd put on Swing Low, Sweet Cadillac, or Umbrella Man by Dizzy Gillespie. Hot House by Charlie Parker was a good record to wake up to. Ruby, My Dear by Monk was another one. Monk played at the Blue Note on 3rd Street with John Orr on the bass and the drummer Frankie Dunlap. Sometimes he'd be in there in the afternoon sitting at the piano all alone playing stuff that sounded like Ivory Joe Hunter, a big half-eaten sandwich left on top of his piano. I dropped in there once in the afternoon just to listen, told him that I played folk music up the street. "We all play folk music," he said. Monk was in his own dynamic universe even when he dawdled around. Even then, he summoned magic shadows into being. I liked modern jazz a lot, liked to listen to it in clubs, but I didn't follow it and I wasn't caught up in it. There weren't any ordinary words with specific meanings, and I needed to hear things plain and simple in the King's English, and folk songs were what spoke to me most directly. Tony Bennett sang in the King's English, and one of his records was laying around, the one called Hit Songs of Tony Bennett, which had In the Middle of an Island, Rags to Riches, and the Hank Williams song, Cold, Cold Heart. The first time I heard Hank Williams, he was singing on the Grand Ole Opry, a Saturday night radio show broadcast out of Nashville. The sound of his voice went through me like an electric rod, and I managed to get a hold of a few of his 78s, Baby We're Really in Love, and Honky Tonkin', and Lost Highway, and I played them endlessly. They called him a hillbilly singer, but I didn't know what that was. Homer and Jethro were more like what I thought a hillbilly was. Hank was no burrhead. There was nothing clownish about him. Even at a young age, I identified fully with him. I didn't have to experience anything that Hank did to know what he was singing about. I'd never seen a robin weep, but could imagine it, and it made me sad. When he sang the news is out all over town, I knew what news that was, even though I didn't know. First chance I got, I was going to go out to the dance and wear out my shoes, too. I learned later that Hank had died in the back seat of a car on New Year's Day. Kept my fingers crossed, hoped it wasn't true. But it was true. It was like a great tree had fallen. Hearing about Hank's death caught me squarely on the shoulder. The silence of outer space never seemed so loud. Intuitively, I knew, though, that his voice would never drop out of sight or fade away. A voice like a beautiful horn. In time, I became aware that in Hank's recorded songs were the archetype rules of poetic songwriting. The architectural forms are like marble pillars and they had to be there. Even his words, all of his syllables are divided up so they make perfect mathematical sense. You can learn a lot about the structure of songwriting by listening to his records, and I listened to them a lot and had them internalized. In a few years' time, Robert Shelton, the folk and jazz critic for the New York Times, would review one of my performances and would say something like, "Resembling a cross between a choir boy and a beatnik, he breaks all the rules in songwriting except of having something to say." The rules, whether Shelton knew it or not, were Hank's rules, but it wasn't like I ever meant to break them. It's just that what I was trying to express was beyond the circle. I woke up around midday to the smell of frying steak and onions on a gas burner. Chloe was standing over the stove and the pan was sizzling. She wore a Japanese kimono over a red flannel shirt, and the smell was assaulting my nostrils. I felt like I needed a face mask. I had planned to go see Woody Guthrie earlier, but when I woke up, the weather was too stormy. I had tried to visit Woody regularly, but now it was getting harder to do. Woody had been confined to Greystone Hospital in Morristown, New Jersey, and I would usually take the bus from the Port Authority terminal, make the hour-and-a-half ride, and then walk the rest of the half-mile up the hill of the hospital. A gloomy and threatening granite building. Looked like a medieval fortress. Woody always asked me to bring him cigarettes, Raleigh cigarettes. Usually I'd play him his songs during the afternoon. Sometimes he'd ask for specific ones. Ranger's Command, Do Re Mi, Dust Bowl Blues, Pretty Boy Floyd, Tom Joad, a song he'd written after seeing the movie The Grapes of Wrath. I knew all those songs and many more. Woody was not celebrated at this place, and it was a strange environment to meet anybody, least of all the true voice of the American spirit. The place was really an asylum with no spiritual hope of any kind. Wailing could be heard in the hallways. Most of the patients wore ill-fitted striped uniforms, and they would file in and out, walking aimlessly while I played Woody's songs. One guy's head would be constantly falling forward on his knees. Then he'd raise up and would fall forward again. Another guy thought he was being chased by spiders, and he twirled in circles, hands slapping his arms and legs. Somebody else who imagined he was the president wore an Uncle Sam hat. Patients rolled their eyes, tongues, sniffed the air, one guy continually licking his lips. An orderly in a white gown told me that the guy eats communists for breakfast. The scene was frightful, but Woody Guthrie was oblivious to all of it. A male nurse would usually bring him out to see me, and then after I'd been there a while, would lead him away. On one of my visits, Woody had told me about some boxes of songs and poems that he had written that had never been seen or set to melodies, that they were stored in the basement of his house in Coney Island, and that I was welcome to them. He told me that if I wanted any of them, to go see Margie, his wife, explain what I was there for. She'd unpack them for me. He gave me directions on how to find the house. In the next day or so, I took the subway from the West 4th Street station all the way to the last stop, like he said. In Brooklyn, stepped out on the platform and went hunting for the house. Woody had said it was easy to find. I saw what looked to be a row of houses across from a field, the kind he described, and I walked toward it only to discover I was walking out across a swamp. I sunk into the water, knee level, but kept going anyway. I could see the lights as I moved forward. Didn't really see any other way to go. When I came out on the other end, my pants from the knees down were drenched. Frozen solid and my feet almost numb, but I found the house and knocked on the door. A babysitter opened it slightly, said that Margie, Woody's wife, wasn't there. One of Woody's kids, Arlo, who would later become a professional singer and songwriter in his own right, told the babysitter to let me in. Arlo was probably about 10 or 12 years old and didn't know anything about any manuscripts locked in the basement. I didn't want to push it. The babysitter was uncomfortable, and I stayed just long enough to warm up, said a quick goodbye and left with my boots still waterlogged, trudged back across the swamp to the subway platform. 40 years later, these lyrics would fall into the hands of Billy Bragg and the group Wilco, and they would put melodies to them, bring them to full life and record them. These performers probably weren't even born when I had made the trip out to Brooklyn. I wouldn't be going to see Woody today. I was sitting in Chloe's kitchen, and the wind was howling and whistling by the window. I could look out on the street and see in both directions. Snow was falling like white dust, up the street, towards the river. I watched a blonde lady in a fur coat with a guy in a heavy overcoat who walked with a limp. I watched them for a while and then looked over to the calendar on the wall. March was coming in like a lion, and once more I wondered what it would take to get into a recording studio, to get signed by a folk record label. Was I getting any closer? No Happiness for Slater, a song off the Modern Jazz Quartet's record, played in the apartment. The apartment was a good place to hibernate. Chloe slapped some steak and onions on my plate and said, "Here, it's good for you." She was cool as pie, hip from head to toe, a Maltese kitten, a solid viper, always hit the nail on the head. I don't know how much weed she smoked, but a lot. She also had her own ideas about the nature of things. Told me that death was an impersonator, that birth was an invasion of privacy. What could you say? You couldn't say anything back when she said stuff like that. It's not like you could prove her wrong. New York City didn't faze her at all. A bunch of monkeys in this town, she'd say. Talking to her, you get the idea right away. I put on my hat and coat, grabbed my guitar, and started bundling up. Chloe knew that I was trying to get places. Maybe someday your name will get around the country like wildfire, she'd say. If you ever get a couple of $100, buy me something. I shut the door behind me and went out into the hallway and down the spiral cascading staircase, got down to the marble-floored landing at the bottom and went out through the narrow courtyard entryway. The walls smelled of chloride. I walked leisurely through the door and up the sidewalk through the latticed iron gate, threw a scarf around my face and headed for Van Damme Street. On the corner, I passed a horse-drawn wagon full of covered flowers, all under plastic wrap. No driver in sight. The city was full of stuff like that. Folk songs played in my head. They always did. Folk songs were the underground story. If someone were to ask what's going on, Mr. Garfield's been shot down, laid down, nothing you can do. That's what's going on. Nobody needed to ask who Mr. Garfield was. They just nodded, they just knew. It was what the country was talking about. Everything was simple, seemed to make some kind of splendid formulaic sense. New York City was cold, muffled, and mysterious. The capital of the world. On 7th Avenue, I passed the building where Walt Whitman had lived and worked. I paused momentarily, imagining him printing away and singing the true song of his soul. I had stood outside of Poe's house on 3rd Street, too, and had done the same thing, staring mournfully up at the windows. The city was like some uncarved block without any name or shape, and it showed no favoritism. Everything was always new, always changing. It was never the same old crowd upon the streets. I crossed over from Hudson to Spring, past a garbage can loaded with bricks, and stopped into a coffee shop. The waitress at the lunch counter wore a close-fitting suede blouse. It outlined the well-rounded lines of her body. She had blue-black hair covered with a kerchief and piercing blue eyes, clear stenciled eyebrows. I was wishing she'd pin a rose on me. She poured the steaming coffee and I turned back towards the street window. The whole city was dangling in front of my nose. I had a vivid idea of where everything was. The future was nothing to worry about. It was awfully close. New morning. I had just returned to Woodstock from the Midwest, from my father's funeral. There was a letter from Archibald MacLeish waiting for me on the table. MacLeish, poet laureate of America, the poet of night stones and the quick earth. The previous week had left me drained. I had gone back to the town of my early years in a way I could never have imagined, to see my father laid to rest. Now there would be no way to say what I was never capable of saying before. Growing up, the cultural and generational differences had been insurmountable, nothing but the sound of voices, colorless, unnatural speech. My father, who was plain-speaking and straight-talking, had said, "Isn't an artist a fellow who paints?" when told by one of my teachers that his son had the nature of an artist. It seemed I'd always been chasing after something, anything that moved, a car, a bird, a blowing leaf, anything that might lead me into some more lit place, some unknown land downriver. I had not even the vaguest notion of the broken world I was living in, what society could do with you. When I left home, it was like Columbus going off into the desolate Atlantic. I'd done that, and I'd been to the ends of the earth, to the water's edge, and now I was back in Spain, back where it all started, in the court of the queen, with a half-glazed expression on my face, with even a wisp of a beard. "What's with the decoration?" one of my neighbors who had come to pay their respects said, pointing to my face. In the short time I was there, it all came back to me. All the flim-flam, the older order of things, the simple Simons. But something else did, too. That my father was the best man in the world and probably worth 100 of me, but he didn't understand me. The town he lived in and the town I lived in were not the same. All that aside, we had more in common now than ever. I, too, was a father three times over. There was a lot I wanted to share, to tell him. And also now I was in a position to do a lot of things for him. Archie's letter said that he'd like to meet with me to discuss the possibility of me composing some songs for a play that he was writing, called Scratch, based on a Stephen Vincent Benet short story. My wife and I drove over to Conway, Massachusetts, where he lived, to meet with him about his new play. It seemed like a civilized thing to do. MacLeish wrote deep poems, was the man of the godless sand. He could take real people from history, people like Emperor Charles or Montezuma or Cortez the Conquistador, and with the tender touch of a creator, deliver them right to your door. He praised the sun and the great sky. It was fitting that I'd go see him. The events of the day, all the cultural mumbo-jumbo, were imprisoning my soul, nauseating me. Civil rights and political leaders being gunned down, the mounting of barricades, the government crackdowns, the student radicals and demonstrators versus the cops and the unions, the streets exploding, fire of anger boiling, the contra communes, the lying, noisy voices, the free love, the anti-money system movement, the whole shebang. I was determined to put myself beyond the reach of it all. I was a family man now, didn't want to be in that group portrait. MacLeish's place was up past a quaint village on a quiet Mount Laurel road, bright maple leaves piled high around the walkway. It was easy walking across the small footbridge leading to a wood-shaded alcove and a reconstructed stone cottage with modern kitchen facilities, MacLeish's studio. A caretaker had let us in, and his wife placed a tray of tea on the table, said something cordial, and then left. My wife went with her. I glanced around the room. There were gardening boots in the corner, photos on the desk and framed on the walls, lace-capped flowers with dark stems, baskets of flowers, geraniums, dusty leaf flowers, white cloth, silver plates, bright fireplace, circular shadows, gallery forest out the window in full bloom. I heard his steps coming up the stone pathway, and he entered the room, came forward and extended his hand. He got straight to it, starts right up the track. Tells me that he considers me a serious poet and that my work would be a touchstone for generations after me, that I was a post-war Iron Age poet, but that I had seemingly inherited something metaphysical from a bygone era. He appreciated my songs because they involved themselves with society. MacLeish asked me who my boyhood heroes were, and I told him, Robin Hood and St. George the Dragon Slayer. You wouldn't want to get on their bad side, he chuckled. The play for which he wanted me to write songs was laying on his reading desk. He wanted songs in it that made some comment to go along with the scenes, and he began reading out loud some of the speeches and suggested some song titles. Father of Night, Red Hands, Lower World were a few of them. After listening intently, I intuitively realized that I didn't think this was for me. I didn't see how our destinies could be intermixed. This play was dark, painted a world of paranoia, guilt, and fear. It was all blacked out and met the atomic age head-on, reeked of foul play. There really wasn't much to say or add to it. The play spelled death for society, with humanity lying face down in its own blood. MacLeish's play was delivering something beyond an apocalyptic message, something like man's mission is to destroy the earth. MacLeish was signaling something through the flames. The play was up to something, and I didn't think I wanted to know. That being said, I told MacLeish I would think about it. In 1968, the Beatles were in India. America was wrapped in a blanket of rage. Students at universities were wrecking parked cars, smashing windows. The war in Vietnam was sending the country into a deep depression. The cities were in flames. The bludgeons were coming down. Hard-hat union guys were beating kids with baseball bats. The fictitious Don Juan, the mysterious medicine man from Mexico, had become a new consciousness craze, had brought in a new level of awareness or life force and was wielding it like a machete. Acid tests were in full swing. Acid was giving people the right attitude. The new worldview was changing society and everything was moving fast, lickety-split. If you saw the news, you'd think that the whole nation was on fire. It seemed like every day there was a whole new riot in another city, everything on the edge of danger and change. The jungles of America being cleared away. Things that had used to be in traditional black and white were now exploding in full sunny color. I had been in a motorcycle accident and I'd been hurt, but I recovered. Truth was, I wanted to get out of the rat race. Having children changed my life and segregated me from just about everybody and everything that was going on. Outside of my family, nothing held any real interest for me, and I was seeing everything through different glasses. Even the horrifying news items of the day, the gunning down of the Kennedys, King, Malcolm X, I didn't see them as leaders being shot down, but rather as fathers whose families had been left wounded. Being born and raised in America, the country of freedom and independence, I had always cherished the values and ideals of equality and liberty. I was determined to raise my children with those ideals. A few years earlier, Ronnie Gilbert, one of the Weavers, had introduced me at one of the Newport Folk Festivals, saying, "And here he is. Take him. You know him. He's yours." I had failed to sense the ominous forebodings in the introduction. Elvis had never been introduced like that. Take him, he's yours? What a crazy thing to say. Screw that. As far as I knew, I didn't belong to anybody, then or now. I had a wife and children whom I loved more than anything else in the world. I was trying to provide for them, keep out of trouble, but the big bugs in the press kept promoting me as the mouthpiece, spokesman, or even conscience of a generation. That was funny. All I'd ever done was sing songs that were dead straight and expressed powerful new realities. I had very little in common with and knew even less about a generation I was supposed to be the voice of. I'd left my hometown only 10 years earlier. Wasn't vociferating the opinions of anybody. My destiny lay down the road with whatever life invited, had nothing to do with representing any kind of civilization. Being true to yourself, that was the thing. I was more a cowpuncher than a Pied Piper. People think that fame and riches translate into power, that it brings glory and honor and happiness. Maybe it does, but sometimes it doesn't. I found myself stuck in Woodstock, vulnerable and with a family to protect. If you looked in the press, though, you saw me being portrayed as anything but that. It was surprising how thick the smoke had become. It seems like the world has always needed a scapegoat, someone to lead the charge against the Roman Empire. But America wasn't the Roman Empire, and someone else would have to step up and volunteer. I really was never any more than what I was, a folk musician who gazed into the gray mist with tear-blinded eyes and made up songs that floated in a luminous haze. Now it had blown up in my face and was hanging over me. I wasn't a preacher performing miracles. It would have driven anybody mad. Early on, Woodstock had been a quiet refuge, but now no more. Road maps to our homestead must have been posted in all 50 states for gangs of dropouts and druggies. Moochers showed up from as far away as California on pilgrimages. Goons were breaking into our place all hours of the night. At first it was merely the nomadic homeless making illegal entry. Seemed harmless enough, but then the rogue radicals looking for the prince of protest began to arrive. I wanted to set fire to these people. These gate crashers, spooks, trespassers, demagogues were all disrupting my home life, and it was backing me into a corner. Once in the midsummer madness, I was riding in a car with Robbie Robertson, the guitar player in what was later to be called the band. I felt like I might as well have been living in another part of the solar system. He says to me, "Where do you think you're going to take it?" I said, "Take what?" "You know, the whole music scene." "The whole music scene?" The car window was rolled down about an inch. I rolled it down the rest of the way, felt a gust of wind blow into my face, and waited for what he said to die away. It was like dealing with a conspiracy. No place was far enough away. I don't know what everybody else was fantasizing about, but what I was fantasizing about was a 9-to-5 existence. A house on a tree-lined block with a white picket fence, pink roses in the backyard. That would have been nice. That was my deepest dream. After a while, you learn that privacy is something you can sell, but you can't buy it back. Woodstock had turned into a nightmare, a place of chaos. Now it was time to scramble out of there in search of some new silver lining, and that was what we did. We moved to New York City for a while in hopes to demolish my identity, but it wasn't any better there. It was even worse. Demonstrators found our house and paraded up and down the front of it chanting and shouting, demanding for me to come out and lead them somewhere. Stop shirking my duties as the conscience of a generation. The neighbors hated us. To them, it must have seemed like I was something out of a carnival show, some exhibition in the Palace of Wonders. They would stare at me when they saw me, like they'd stare at a shrunken head or a giant jungle rat. I pretended that I didn't care. Eventually, we tried moving west, tried a few different places, but in short time, reporters would come sniffing around in hopes to gain some secret. Maybe I'd confess some sin. Even if these reporters had been allowed in the house, what would they find? A whole lot of stuff. Stacking toys, push-and-pull toys, child-sized tables and chairs, big empty cardboard boxes, science kits, puzzles, and toy drums. I wasn't going to let anybody in the house. As for house rules, we didn't have many. If the kids wanted to play basketball in the kitchen, they played basketball in the kitchen. If they got into pots and pans, we put all the pots and pans on the floor. My house was chaotic inside as well as out. Joan Baez recorded a protest song about me that was getting big play, challenging me to get with it, come out and take charge, lead the masses, be an advocate, lead the crusade. The song called out to me from the radio like a public service announcement. The press never let up. Reporters would shoot questions at me, and I would tell them repeatedly that I was not a spokesman for anything or anybody, and I was only a musician. My wife, when she married me, had no idea of what she was getting into. Me neither, actually, and now we were in a no-win situation. For sure, my lyrics had struck nerves that had never been struck before, but if my songs were just about the words, then what was Duane Eddy, the great rock and roll guitarist, doing recording an album full of instrumental melodies in my songs? Musicians have always known that my songs are about more than just words, but most people are not musicians. What I had to do was